Louie, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the newest Jersey boy, Andy Smerick.
I'm tearing up. My last time here.
Andy, emotional. This is your going away podcast. This is bittersweet for all of us, Andy. We've enjoyed having you here and on the show, but we are glad to see you going on to do big things in New Jersey.
Yeah, I can't wait. It's going to be really, really exciting. It's been fun getting to do this when I was called into duty, so I'm going to miss it.
Yeah. You know, we have been around the office, planning various jokes related to New Jersey, but out of respect for your new state that you will be helping to lead its education system, we are trying to not use any of those jokes. I will say, though, that some of the jokes are coming from somebody who was born and raised in New Jersey, so I feel like that's allowable, right?
It's not allowable.
It's still not allowable.
The beautiful Garden State deserves respect.
Okay. All right, Andy. We're not going to get any traction on that.
I know. That's right.
All right. Well, hey, we have a special part in the Gadfly. We're going to do one question about the week's news, and then because, frankly, there was so little week's news in terms of education, we're going to talk about two of your favorite topics, Race to the Top and Turnarounds.
Okay.
One last time. Andy, you have dominated these issues. I mean, I don't mean just here at Fordham. I mean in the education policy arena. When reporters have wanted to talk Race to the Top or Turnarounds, they have called Andy Smerick. What are they going to do without you?
Well, you're nice for saying that. You're probably giving me too much credit, but Round two is going to be really interesting. There are a lot of organizations out there, especially consulting firms, who have been reading a lot of these applications. And like Charlie Barone from DFER has been doing a lot of work on this. So you're seeing him quoted more and more.
Mm-hmm.
But the big question is going to be when, how many finalists are there, and then mm-hmm. how many actually get the awards. Then we'll see.
I think what you need, Andy, is some kind of alter ego so that reporters can call you while you're still in a new position, but you just use like a pen name.
I mean, this is actually interesting. I can't tell you how many reporters have asked me if I'm going to continue writing when I'm there, and if I can continue to blog, and if I can't officially do it, if I can have like a fake pen name and do it in some other way. Yeah. It's
right.
Very
well,
flattering.
Folks, if you notice a new blogger on our site on Flypaper soon, you'll know what's
Randy
going on.
Derrick.
Randy Derrick. I like it. Okay, Janie, let's get started with Pardon the Gadfly.
A recent New York Times article chronicles the story of a severely disabled student in the New York City school system. After 15 years of instruction and a current price tag of near $60,000 a year, teachers agree that the student has made little to no discernible academic progress. Should public schools be responsible for continuing a student's academic education when it is clear that the student is not making progress?
Well, I'd actually like to get some more of these details. I mean, this is kind of provocative the way that it's worded. So 15 years of education, is the student 20 at the time, 22, 26?
Yeah,
26?
He's about to graduate high school.
And he's made no academic
progress
at all?
No discernible progress.
So this is interesting. Mike and I out in the hallway were kind of talking about this. Like, special education, the people who are experts in this know more than just about anyone else, and the people like me who don't know enough about it know entirely too little. But these big questions become, all right, I mean, what kind of assessments are used? Does he have severe cognitive disabilities? Does he have minor disabilities? What are the disabilities he or she has? I mean, this is a thicket to get into, but I mean,
Andy, that was the most impressive non-answer I've ever heard. What is this? You sign up to be a
bureaucrat.
Bureaucrat. No,
I mean,
get.
As you know, special education is the, I mean, it pulls on the heartstrings of parents who have students who are in special education classes, and yet when taxpayers see a figure like $60,000 times 15,
yeah.
So we're talking almost $1 million,
yeah.
Right there?
Yeah. Get this. I heard today from a large city that will be unnamed that their most expensive student costs $320,000 a year for a private residential program in Florida. $320,000 a year. Whew, that's a lot of money.
No,
so
it is.
And look, we have a moral obligation to serve all kids in this country.
Absolutely.
We should. But I think we have to be honest that there are some kids that have such severe disabilities that what they're going to be able to achieve is fairly limited. And so for a kid like Donovan that was on the New York Times, the main goal may be getting him ready so that he can live in a group home and, you know, live a relatively, peaceful, productive, I don't know how you call it, life. But, you know, this is the same kind of thing that we get into the healthcare debate. Who is going to make the decisions about what's good enough for Donovan, and are we willing to ration money to a degree without saying, hey, the sky is not the limit here? If we could get pretty much just as good of an experience for Donovan for $30,000 as for $60,000, maybe we should do that. And the bottom line is somebody probably in public office has to be able to make those kinds of decisions, and that is very difficult to do.
Yeah, we have these competing interests. So we have the promise of public education. All kids deserve an education. We have IDEA that makes it a civil right. We have NCLB that requires even, severely cognitively disabled kids excluded, all special ed kids to take assessments. So we have all this promise that it's meaningful, that this has to get done, but then we have these cost concerns as well.
Okay. I think we just got dinged. I'm not sure where that came from, but we're going to go on to question number two.
Okay, these are the questions for you, Andy.
Okay.
I get to comment, too.
I mean, they're questions for Andy because it's going away.
I know. Thank you very much. And you can teach me. Teach Andy's me expertise. How to pick up the pick up from where you left off,
yeah.
Andy.
Go ahead.
Okay, first, how do you see the second round of Race to the Top playing out? Will Congress reauthorize it? And what will the history books say?
That's an interesting question. So to begin with, disclosure, everyone knows I'm going to New Jersey. I worked on New Jersey's application. I'm not completely an impartial observer on this one. So the history question is the most interesting thing. And I think looking even to education then outside, it may be the case that we have a formula now that if you have a recession and you have the federal government put money on the table, you might be able to get states, not only in education, but in other fields, to change their policies. So for example, clean energy or transportation or infrastructure years from now, if there's another recession and the federal government says, okay, we're going to give you $100 million to plug your holes, but we're going to put $5 billion to incentivize you to do things. Perhaps Race to the Top taught us that you could actually leverage recessions to get policy change at the state level. As far as Congress reauthorizing it, my money right now is on no. Congress, like Senator Harkin, they want to put more money into formula-based programs instead of competitive ones. So I'd say a 1 in 50 chance that any more money goes into this anytime soon.
So, all right, let's get back to the history, though. I don't want you to dodge this question on education. The big question is, you know, did we get a lot of reform for this money? And you've got from Stephen Brill in New York Times Magazine saying we saw more reform than we have in decades, right? Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, you have some people saying, there hardly anything changed, you know, outside a handful of states. I mean, what's the truth? I mean, how much credit does this thing get for moving the ball forward?
It deserves a good bit of credit. I just looked at a list that the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools put together, and a whole lot of states increased charter caps or improved funding or so forth. A lot of states got rid of their data firewalls. I mean, it wasn't as I try to explain to people, it wasn't a revolution from coast to coast. What it was is you had a handful of states, maybe in the 10-12 range, that did meaningful, substantial things that are going to last. You had another maybe 10 states that did good things, nothing revolutionary, and then you had a whole lot of states that did nothing at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, so the truth is, a lot of stuff got done, more than got done, say, in the previous 5 years or previous 10 years, but it certainly wasn't the kind of thing where we said every single state is a completely different place now, thanks to Race to the Top.
And I guess we'll see if these other lackluster states follow the lead. I mean, you often see this in school reform. There are leading states, and then ideas become more popular and more acceptable, and other folks do them too. Okay, third question, Janie.
How do you see the school improvement grants program playing out? How many schools will be successfully turned around?
Do you want me to take this one first as well?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And remember again, you know, our listeners, they know you, Andy. They know what your real answer would be if you weren't, you know, speaking bureaucratese here.
No,
The real answer would be none of them. None of them. Turnarounds are ridiculous. They don't work.
I'm enough on the record to know people know that I'm lying if I said that I have hope for all the school improvement fund money. I think the way you have to look at this is if the money is used to start new schools, if it's used to shut down low performing schools, we're going to have a much greater chance of seeing substantial, meaningful, sustainable change in the future. But all the reporters I'm talking to about this, whether it's in Poughkeepsie or in Iowa or in Oregon, all of them tell me that what they're seeing is their districts are using up the transformation model. So the lightest touch interventions that are allowable under the school improvement fund, they're using all of the money that they get to do stuff that was done under NCLB that was done pre-NCLB. So what we're going to see is the same activities, but with more money, leading, unfortunately, in most cases, I think, to the same sad results.
So there you have it. $3 bucks flushed down the toilet.
Unless people are smart and do stuff like starting new charter schools, shutting down bad schools, replicating high-performing schools.
Okay. Thank you, Andy. Andy's last part in the gadfly. I think we're going to cry here. But don't cry too much because it's time for...
Time to dance.
Research Minute. All I should have said Amber's research minute, of course.
Hey, well, Amber.
Hey, how you doing?
But I'm sad.
I actually must insert, it's really Janie's research minute this week, because Janie prepared the research minute for me since I was in a very long meeting today.
Wow, calling it in today, Amber.
Calling it in. I called it in.
You know what? I got to say this. We were in this long meeting today. We were brainstorming some new project ideas with a group of experts. I think we can say it around the topic of special education. Fascinating, very interesting conversation. And at the end, Amber was supposed to have half an hour to kind of summarize and talk about next steps. And at some point, we were running late, and I said, it's okay. We've got kind of a lot of padding
was the word
end.
He used.
Oh.
Padding.
And I tried to explain.
That's what he called me. I was the padding.
Amber's used to doing the research minute.
Yeah.
It's only a half an hour.
I said, Mike, please don't dig any deeper. Just turn it over, you know?
You did an excellent job with your 15 minutes.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, Amber, what are we talking about today?
This week, we have the latest volume of Diplomas Count. Came out last week. This is the annual publication of Education Week. Looks, obviously, at graduation rates. So what did we have this year? Our rate is at 68.8% for 2007. That was the most recent year. This is the second year in a row that the rate has fallen a tad after a decade of general improvement. But, interesting part here, the overall rate masked extreme variation. So we've got 56% of Latinos, about 54% of African Americans, and 51% of Native Americans who are making it to high school graduation, which is really appalling. Remarkably, 25 of the nation's 11,000 school districts account for, guess what percentage of all dropouts?
A lot.
20%, which is a lot. Wow. New York City and LA top the list, each failing to graduate more than 40,000 students every year. LA's rate is worse because it's smaller. The publication tends to gloss over one important tidbit, which Janie dug up, and I thought this was good. So while the overall graduate rate has fallen, rates for every single racial group have improved, which is kind of weird, but basically it's the result of ever-expanding minority populations. Right. So because minorities graduate at lower rates and non-minorities, their populations pull down the overall graduation rate, even as their own individual rates improve. So there's some bad news and good news here, but mostly not really good news.
It's so question, the clarification, this is a cohort graduation rate, so they're tracking students,
right,
the
so
ninth
it's
grade
the,
class.
It's the Department of Ed's 2008 little NCLB recalculation of, but yeah, it's a four-year cohort rate, yes.
And just so everyone heard, what is the percentage again, 68?
That would be 68%, yes.
One-third of our students are not graduating from high school.
So
Now, Andy, you know, you kind of responded sharply with your ahs and your oohs when Amber gave the percentages by the different minority
An active
groups.
Listener.
Active, I like that. And empathic, too. That's good. You make eye contact, I love it. Here's a question. I mean, look, I think there's no way to get around the fact that the numbers for African-American kids, Native American kids are depressing, horrible. I want a question about the you know, on the Latino kids. I mean, I feel like we have to put in some perspective here. I mean, you know, if we're talking about kids who came across the border, say, you know, within the last couple of years, like they came across as teenagers, you know, that's kind of a special case. You got to kind of, I mean, I'd be interested to see what these rates compare to in their home countries.
A couple years ago, the report came out, and I forget which organization did it, that did the 50 largest school districts, cities, and what their graduation rates were. And what wasn't it like Indianapolis and Detroit were the two lowest, and each of them
I
were.
I believe so. Was that the dropout factories?
I think so. But the point is, like, a third or less of those students were graduating on time. And so these, like Detroit, for example, which is well over 90% African American, more than two-thirds of their students are dropping out.
Okay.
I mean, it was just, what, 10, 12 years ago when the United States had the greatest graduate. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, you know, and you always hear all these other countries are catching up with us, Finland and Germany and all these other ones.
I think it was probably more like 20 or 30 years ago, though.
Yeah, I remember looking at I look back at the old 2000 OECD report, and it was acted like it was such huge news. The United States had lost its, you know, one of its positions. So, yeah, I wondered how long ago it was.
All right, so this is, I mean, it seems like a bad news story, yet there's some good news here.
Some good news.
I mean, biracial groups, kids are doing better. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So, what is the song
mixed
that goes
news.
Along with it?
So, since we're talking about the happy occasion of graduation and the happy occasion of Andy's new job, we've got "Celebration" by Kool and the Gang.
Let's celebrate that 68% graduation rate. What's on my mind is rate that reform.
Radio.
What's
credit.
On my mind? Rate that
I actually waited this time.
Rate That Reform brought to you this week by Mickey Muldoon. Mickey, we're all mixed up here. I mean, what's going on? Why are you in the Rate That Reform chair?
You know, we like to keep it fresh. We like to keep you off your guard.
And Stafford
happens to be stranded in Pennsylvania. Amber happened to be stranded in a meeting all day, and Janie as well, and we had to accommodate the best we can.
But we are nimble. We are a nimble organization. That's right. Stafford stranded somewhere in the middle of Pennsylvania with a broken down car. And yet somehow she found wireless, and she's been working away.
She has been.
Yeah.
Cardboard coverage these days.
Hardworking people afford them.
Oh, yeah. We don't stop. We don't let some car accident slow us down, Andy.
Yeah, well.
Just remember that if you're slacking over there once you move to New Jersey.
I learned a whole new work ethic here.
Oh, yeah.
So, all right. Mickey, what's the last thing I'm going to hear on as a member of this team?
I am going to beat my dead horse about grading. And, you know, the past 2 or 3 times I've done Rate That Reform, it's been about grading practices. And I'm going to finish with a final bang here. There's a story in the New York Times this week about Loyola Law School in Los Angeles that decided to unilaterally raise all of the GPAs of its graduates and its past graduates for the past 4 years by 0.333333333 repeating.
Was this arbitrary? Did they have a formula or rationale for this?
No, it was anybody who had ever gone through their school automatically got a GPA boost of 0.333333.
The reasoning being?
The reasoning being that their overall average GPA, they said, was lower than other comparable law schools, and because of the tough economy, all their graduates are having a tough time graduating. Their bad GPA looks bad on their U.S. News and World Report scores. And, you know, their graduates are having such a tough time comparing to others that they realize that they must have been grading too harshly and they want to get on the same scale as everybody else so that they would bump it up.
Lord.
0.333. So my point with this is the same as I made about grading before, that having a numerical GPA can be such an incredibly arbitrary thing. And this is just a kind of prime example of this. Just like, oh, it's just a number that you can, you know, adjust if you want. You can tack on 0.3 or, you know, take away 0.33. You know, it doesn't really matter. In this case, the law school is just basically showing that for them GPA represents a stamp on your resume and not actually represents anything having to do with what you have or haven't learned. And I don't know, it's bad. It's
so painful. So what grade do you give to it, Aaron McKee?
So,
and add 0.333 or whatever.
I'm going to give it a fail. I'm a believer.
Is that a 0.0 or would that be a 0.66?
I'll give it a fail because I think pass fail is what a lot of the top law schools, they mention like Harvard and Yale and Stanford, something like that. They do a pass fail system. A lot of med schools do that. And I think that can actually be, in a lot of ways, a better system where you get. You know, you have set a high bar for passing, and there's a pressure all around that you have to, you know, just get by and pass, and there's real risk that you can't. What's the difference?
This is the same time that we're talking about in education. We've had these teacher evaluation systems that are pass-fail, and everybody passes, and we're all excited. No, we're going to move to a 5-point scale, so we can finally differentiate among, you know, really good teachers and medium teachers and mediocre teachers and horrible teachers, and now you're just going to just lump them all together.
I wasn't finished. I was going to say, I think pass-fail, in addition to qualitative standard, in addition to qualitative feedback, where you get feedback on a number of different points.
I think there's an easier solution, right? So internally, so externally, grade point averages are arbitrary, so you can't compare Harvard to Loyola, you just don't know how they would compare. But internally, they can make sense. So it could be on a 4-point, a 10-point, a 20-point scale. Give the kids whatever grades you think are right, but then externally, you, on their resumes, on their transcripts, you show a percentile ranking. Where did that student graduate in his or her class? So she's not coming out with a 3.6, she's coming out at a 15th percent in the graduating class.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, absolutely, yeah.
Did I just solve the problem?
I think that's pretty good. Andy Samarick, you're an A-plus in our book.
The people at home can't see that I'm crying right now.
Okay.
You're so sweet.
All right, Andy. Well, I do hope you'll come visit us sometime when you're in town for a Fancy Pants conference or something like that. You might come by and we'll interview about how things are going in New Jersey.
Yeah, and I want all of you to come up and visit in beautiful New Jersey.
Okay, excellent. Well, until next time.
I'm Andy Samarick for the last time.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, online at edexcellence.net, signing off.